This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death by Caitlin Doty, narrated by the author. Adults who are racked with death anxiety are not odd birds who have contracted some exotic disease, but men and women whose family and culture have failed to knit the proper protective clothing for them to withstand the icy chill of mortality. Irvin Yalom, psychiatrist. Author's note. From Here to Eternity is a work of nonfiction. I have changed a small number of names and descriptive details. Introduction. The phone rang, and my heart raced. The first few months after I opened my funeral home, a ringing phone qualified as a thrilling event. We didn't get many calls. What if someone died? I'd gasp. Well, yes, dear, it's a funeral home. That would be the point. The voice on the other end was a hospice nurse. She had declared Josephine dead 10 minutes ago. The body was still warm to the touch. The nurse sat at the dead woman's bedside, having an argument with Josephine's daughter. The daughter had chosen to call my funeral home because she didn't want her mother whisked away the second she took her final breath. She wanted to keep Mom's body at home. Can she do that? Of course she can, I replied. In fact, we encourage it. That's not illegal? The nurse asked skeptically. It's not illegal. Usually we call the funeral home and they pick up the body within the hour. The daughter is in control of her body, not the hospice, not a hospital or nursing home, definitely not the funeral home. Well, okay, if you're sure. I'm sure, I said. Please tell Josephine's daughter she can call us back later this evening, or tomorrow morning if she'd prefer, whenever she's ready. We picked up Josephine at 8 p.m., 6 hours after her death. The next day, her daughter sent us a video she shot on her cell phone. In the 30-second clip, the dead woman lies in bed, dressed in her favorite sweater and scarf. Candles flicker on the dresser beside the bed, and the body is covered in flower petals. Even in the grainy cell phone footage, you can tell that Josephine looked radiant her last night on Earth. Her daughter felt genuine pride in her accomplishment. Her mother had always taken care of her, and now she was taking care of her mother. Not everyone in the industry is supportive of the way I run my funeral home. Some believe a dead body must be embalmed to be safe, untrue, and that a body should be handled only by licensed professionals, also untrue. The dissenters imagine that younger, progressive morticians are starting to make our profession look like a joke and wonder if circus is the right word for what funeral service is becoming. One gentleman promised the day the funeral business turns into 3-day visitations at the house of an unembalmed body, I'm done. In America, where I live, death has been big business since the turn of the 20th century. A century has proven the perfect amount of time for its citizens to forget what funerals once were, family and community-run affairs. In the 19th century, no one would have questioned Josephine's daughter preparing her mother's body. It would have seemed strange if she didn't. No one would have questioned a wife washing and dressing the body of her husband or a father carrying his son to the grave in a homemade coffin. In an impressively short time, America's funeral industry has become more expensive, more corporate, and more bureaucratic than any other funeral industry on Earth. If we can be called the best at anything, it would be at keeping our grieving families separated from their dead. 5 years ago, when my funeral home, and this book, was still a gleam in my eye, I rented a hut on a rural lagoon in Belize. At that time, I lived the glamorous life of a crematory worker and body transport driver. The hut had to be very inexpensive. It had neither cell phone service nor Wi-Fi. The lagoon was 9 miles from the nearest town, reachable only by four-wheel drive. The driver was the caretaker of the property, a 30-year-old Belizean man named Luciano. To give you a sense of Luciano, he was shadowed everywhere by his pack of loyal, if somewhat emaciated, dogs. When the hut was unoccupied, he would head into the Belizean bush for days at a time, wearing flip-flops, carrying his machete, followed by the dogs. He hunted deer, tapir, and armadillo, and when he caught one, he would kill it, flay it, and eat its heart out of its chest. Luciano asked me what I did for a living. When I told him I worked with the dead, at a crematory, he sat up in his hammock. "You burn them?" he asked. "You barbecue people?" I considered this description. "Well, the machine is hotter than that. It gets over 1,800 degrees, so you blast right through the barbecue stage, but pretty much, yes." When someone died in Luciano's community, the family would bring the body home for a full-day wake. Belize has a diverse population, sandwiched between Caribbean and Latin American influences, with English as the national language. Luciano identified as a mestizo, a descendant of the indigenous Maya and the Spanish colonizers. Luciano's grandfather was his community's death attendant, the guy a local family would call to prepare a body. When he arrived, sometimes the body would be in rigor mortis, the muscles rendered so stiff it was a challenge to dress and bathe the corpse. According to Luciano, if that were the case, his grandfather would talk to the body. "Look, you want to look good in heaven? I can't dress you if you want to be hard." "So your grandfather would talk the corpse out of rigor mortis?" I asked. "Well, you also had to rub a little rum on it to make it loosen up, but yeah, he would just talk to the body," he replied. After convincing the body to loosen up, his grandfather would flip it over on its stomach and press out any purge or gas from decomposition, kind of like burping a baby. Burp it before it burps on you. "Is that your job in America, too?" he wondered, gazing out over the lagoon. Of course, the larger cities in Belize have funeral homes that adopted the American business models, upselling families on mahogany caskets and marble headstones. The same push toward modernity goes for Belizean hospitals, which may require that an autopsy be performed, whether the family wants the procedure or not. Luciano's grandmother, before she died, refused to be cut open. "That's why we thieved her body from the hospital," Luciano told me. "I'm sorry, what?" I had heard correctly. They stole her body from the hospital, just wrapped it in a sheet, and took it. "What was the hospital going to do to us?" Luciano asked. He had a similar story about his friend, who drowned in this very lagoon. Luciano hadn't bothered to call the authorities to report the drowning. He was dead. What did they have to do with it? When he dies, Luciano would like to be buried in a simple hole, shrouded with an animal skin, with leaves lining the walls of the grave. He plans on designing the animal shroud himself. He explained that he talks about death all the time with his friends. They ask each other, "Hey, what do you want when you die?" Luciano asked, "Don't people say that where you come from?" It was hard to explain that no, for the most part, they really don't. One of the chief questions in my work has always been why my own culture is so squeamish around death. Why do we refuse to have these conversations, asking our family and friends what they want done with their body when they die? Our avoidance is self-defeating. By dodging the talk about our inevitable end, we put both our pocketbooks and our ability to mourn at risk. I believed that if I could witness firsthand how death is handled in other cultures, I might be able to demonstrate that there is no one prescribed way to do or understand death. In the last several years, I have traveled to observe death rituals as they are practiced around the world. In Australia, England, Germany, Spain, Italy, Indonesia, Mexico, Bolivia, Japan, and throughout the U.S. There is much to learn from the cremation pyres of India and the whimsical coffins of Ghana. But the places I chose to visit have tales equally spectacular and less often told. I hope that what I found might help us reclaim meaning and tradition in our own communities. Such reclamation is important to me as a funeral home owner, but more so as a daughter and a friend. The Greek historian Herodotus, writing over 2,000 years ago, produced one of the first descriptions of one culture getting worked up over the death rituals of another. In the story, the ruler of the Persian Empire summons a group of Greeks before him. Since they cremate their dead, the king wonders, what would it take for them to eat their dead fathers? The Greeks balk at this question, explaining that no price in the world would be high enough to turn them into cannibals. Next, the king summons a group of Calatians, known for eating the bodies of their dead. He asks, what price would make them burn their dead fathers with fire? The Calatians beg him not to mention such horrors. That attitude, revulsion at the way other groups handle their dead, has endured through millennia. If you have ever come within 500 feet of a modern funeral home, you know that morticians love the following quote, attributed to William Gladstone, a 19th century British prime minister. Show me the manner in which a nation cares for its dead, and I will measure with mathematical exactness the tender mercies of its people, their respect for the laws of the land, and their loyalty to high ideals. They etch the quote onto wall plaques and feature it prominently on their websites alongside American flag gifts and Muzak tracks of Amazing Grace. Unfortunately, Gladstone never supplied the equation that would allow us to determine, with his promised mathematical exactness, that one particular method of handling the dead is 79.9% barbaric, while another is 62.4% dignified. In fact, Gladstone may have never even produced this quote at all. It is first recorded as appearing in a March 1938 issue of The American Cemetery, in an article called Successful Cemetery Advertising. I can't prove Gladstone didn't say it, but one prominent Gladstone scholar told me he had never come across the quote. The furthest he would go was to say it sounded like something he could have said. Even if we recognize the benefits of another culture's ritual, we often allow bias to undermine those feelings of acceptance. In 1636, 2,000 indigenous Wendat people gathered around a communal burial pit on the shores of what is now Lake Huron, Canada. The grave measured 6 feet deep and 24 feet across and was designed to hold the bones of 700 individuals. For the bones, the burial pit was not their first stop after death. When the bones were still fresh corpses, they were wrapped in beaver skin robes and placed on wooden scaffolds 10 feet off the ground. Every decade or so, the scattered Huron-Wendat communities would gather their remains for the communal burial, known as the Feast of the Dead. In preparation, the bodies were brought down from the scaffolds. Family members, mostly women, were tasked with scraping the bones clean of any lingering flesh. How difficult it was to clean the bones varied according to how long the person had been dead. Some bodies had decomposed, and only dried, paper-thin skin still clung to the skeleton. Other bodies were preserved and near mummified, requiring the desiccated flesh to be pulled off in strips and burned. The most challenging bodies belonged to the recently deceased, still swarming with maggots. This cleaning ritual was witnessed and recorded by Jean de Brébeuf, a Catholic missionary from France. Instead of reacting with horror, he wrote with great admiration of the intimate way the families treated the bodies. In one such case, Brebeuf observed a family unwrap a corpse oozing with decomposition. The family, undaunted, plunged in to clean the bones and rewrap them in a new beaver robe. Brebeuf asked if this was not a noble example to inspire Christians. He expressed similar admiration when it came to the ceremony at the burial pit. When the bodies were covered over with sand and bark, he found it heartening to see such works of mercy take place. In that moment, standing at the edge of the pit, I'm sure Brebeuf was moved by the death rituals of the Wendat people. But it did not change his final fervent hope that all of their customs and ceremonies would be obliterated and replaced with Christian ceremonies so they could be sacred as opposed to foolish and useless. It should be stated that the indigenous people of Canada were not altogether open-minded toward the alternative rituals that missionary de Brebeuf offered. Historian Eric Seaman wrote that the First Nations and Europeans often discovered chilling perversions about each other. How were the Wendats expected to believe the French Catholics had noble aims when they freely admitted to cannibalism, bragging that they consumed flesh and blood of their own God, no less, in a practice called communion? Since religion is the source of many death rituals, often we invoke belief to denigrate the practices of others. As recently as 1965, James W. Frazier wrote in Cremation, Is It Christian? Spoiler, no. That to cremate was a barbarous act and an aid to crime. To a decent Christian, it is repulsive to think of the body of a friend being treated like a beef roast in the oven with all of its running fats and sizzling tissues. I have come to believe that the merits of a death custom are not based on mathematics, e.g. 36.7% a barbarous act, but on emotions, a belief in the unique nobility of one's own culture. That is to say, we consider death rituals savage only when they don't match our own. On my last day in Belize, Luciano took me to the cemetery that houses his grandparents, including the stolen grandmother. The cemetery was filled with above-ground concrete graves, some well-tended, some fallen into disrepair. One cross, knocked over into the weeds, was wrapped in a pair of ladies' underwear. Someone had taken black spray paint and crudely painted Gaza Earth and Repent All Man on a pair of graves. Back in the far corner, under a tree, his grandparents' caskets lay stacked one on top of the other, enclosed in one of the concrete-covered graves. My grandmother, she didn't want all this cement. She just wanted a hole in the ground, dust to dust. But, you know, Luciano lovingly swept the dead leaves off the top of the grave. What struck me was how Luciano had been present for every step of his grandmother's death, from stealing her body from the hospital to holding a wake where the family drank rum and played ranchera music, Grandma's favorite, to tending her grave years later. Contrast that with the Western funeral industry, where mourners must navigate purposeful obfuscations after every loss. Most people could not tell you what chemicals are pumped into their mother during an embalming procedure. Answer, some combination of formaldehyde, methanol, ethanol, and phenol. Or why they're required to purchase a $3,000 stainless steel vault at the cemetery. Answer, so the groundskeeping staff has an easier time mowing the grass. In 2017, an NPR investigation into funeral homes found a confusing, unhelpful system that seems designed to be impenetrable by average consumers who must make costly decisions at a time of grief and financial stress. We need to reform our funeral industry, introducing new practices that aren't so profit-oriented and that do more to include the family. But we cannot begin to reform or even question our death systems when we act like little Jean de Brebeufs falsely convinced that we have it right, while all these other people are disrespectful and barbarous. This dismissive attitude can be found in places you'd never expect. Lonely Planet, the largest guidebook publisher in the world, included the idyllic Trunyan Cemetery in their book on visiting Bali. In Trunyan, the villagers weave bamboo cages for their dead to decompose in, and then stack the skulls and bones out in a lush green landscape. Lonely Planet, instead of explaining the meaning behind these ancient customs, advised wise travelers to skip the ghoulish spectacle. Cannibalizing your dear old dad, like the Calatians, may never be for you. It's not for me, either. I'm a vegetarian. Kidding, Dad. Still, it's demonstrably wrong to claim that the West has death rituals that are superior to those of the rest of the world. What's more, due to the corporatization and commercialization of death care, we have fallen behind the rest of the world when it comes to proximity, intimacy, and ritual around death. The good news. We are not beholden to our distance from and shame around death. The first step to fixing the problem is to show up, to be present and engaged. In large modern cities like Tokyo and Barcelona, I saw families show up to spend the day with the body and stay to witness the cremation. In Mexico, I saw families visit the cemetery to leave offerings years after the death occurred, ensuring that no one is forgotten. Many of the rituals in this book will be very different from your own, but I hope you will see the beauty in that difference. You may be someone who experiences real fear and anxiety around death, but you are here. Just like the people you are about to meet, you have shown up. Colorado, Crestone. One afternoon in August, I received the email I had been waiting for. Caitlin, Laura, a very dear member of our community, was found dead early this morning. She had a history of heart problems and had just entered her 75th year. Don't know where you are, but you're welcome to join us. Stephanie. Laura's death was unexpected. On Sunday night, she danced with abandon at a local music festival. On Monday morning, she lay dead on her kitchen floor. On Thursday morning, her family would gather to cremate her, and I would be there. The cremation was scheduled to start promptly at 7 a.m., just as the sun broke through the blue light of dawn. The mourners began to stream in after 6:30. A truck pulled up, driven by Laura's son, bearing her body wrapped in a coral-colored shroud. There had been a rumor that her horse, Bebe, would be making an appearance, but at the last minute, the family decided the crowd and the fire would be too much for Bebe's constitution. The announcement came that the horse was, regretfully, unable to attend. Laura's family pulled her body from the pickup and carried her on a cloth stretcher through the field of black-eyed Susans, up the slight incline toward the pyre. A gong rang through the air. As I walked from the parking area up the sandy path, a beaming volunteer handed me a freshly cut bough of juniper. Laura was laid out on a metal grate atop two parallel slabs of smooth white concrete under the expansive dome of Colorado sky. I had come to visit the empty pyre twice before, but its purpose became more sober and clear with the presence of a body. One by one, mourners stepped forward to lay a juniper bough on Laura's body. As the only person present who hadn't known her, I hesitated to deposit my juniper, call it funereal awkwardness. But I couldn't very well hang on to my bough, too obvious, or stuff it in my backpack, tacky, so I walked forward and rested it on the shroud. Laura's family, including a young boy of 8 or 9, circled her pyre, stacking pinyon pine and spruce logs, selected because they burned with heightened intensity. Laura's partner and her adult son waited at the corners with lit torches. A signal was given, and they came together to set Laura aflame, just as the sun peered above the horizon. As her body caught fire, white smoke swirled about in tiny cyclones, twisting upward and disappearing into the morning sky. The smell called to mind a passage from Edward Abbey. The fire. The odor of burning juniper is the sweetest fragrance on the face of the earth, in my honest judgment. I doubt if all the smoking censers of Dante's paradise could equal it. One breath of juniper smoke, like the perfume of sagebrush after rain, evokes in magical catalysis, like certain music, the space and light and clarity and piercing strangeness of the American West. Long may it burn. After a few minutes, the whirlwinds dispersed, and glowing red flames danced in their place. The fire gathered strength, shooting up 6 feet high. The mourners, all 130 of them, ringed the pyre in silence. The only sound was the pop of flaming wood, as if one by one Laura's memories were diffusing into the ether. Cremation, in the form they practice it in the tiny town of Crestone, Colorado, has been around for tens of thousands of years. The ancient Greeks, Romans, and Hindus were most famous for employing the modest alchemy of fire to consume the flesh and liberate the soul. But cremation itself goes back even further. In the late 1960s, in the remote Australian outback, a young geologist discovered the cremated bones of an adult woman. He estimated the bones might be up to 20,000 years old. In fact, further study revealed that they were 42,000 years old, antedating the supposed arrival of the Aboriginal people in Australia by some 22,000 years. The woman would have lived in a verdant landscape filled with giant creatures, kangaroos, wombats, other rodents of unusual size. For food, she collected fish, seeds, and the eggs of enormous emus. When she died, the woman, now known as Mungo Lady, was cremated by her community. After the cremation, her bones were crushed and then burned again in a second cremation. They were ritually covered with red ochre before being buried in the ground, where they lay resting for 42,000 years. Speaking of Australia, this transition will pay off, I promise. 10 minutes into Laura's cremation, one of the fire tenders picked up a didgeridoo and signaled a gentleman holding a wooden flute to join her. I braced myself. The didgeridoo is a ludicrous instrument for an American funeral. But the combination of the didgeridoo's all-encompassing drone and the flute's lament was haunting, soothing the crowd as they stared deeper into the flames. And so it goes. Another American small town, another grieving community gathered around the pyre. Except, obviously, not. Crestone's pyre is the only community open-air pyre in America, and, in fact, in the Western world. There is one other pyre, a private pyre, at the Shambhala Mountain Center, a Buddhist retreat in northern Colorado. Cremations in Crestone didn't always employ such stirring rituals. Before the processions at dawn and the didgeridoos and the well-organized juniper dispersers, there were Stephanie, Paul, and their portapyre. "We were the portapyre people," Stephanie Gaines explained matter-of-factly. She describes herself as a hyper-engaged Buddhist. "I'm a power Aries," she added, "a triple Aries, my sun, moon, and ascendant." At 72, she rules Crestone's pyre operation with logistics, charm, and a white-banged bob. Stephanie and Paul Kloppenberg, an equally enchanting character with a thick Dutch accent, kept the pyre mobile, moving it from place to place, cremating on private property, swooping in and out before the county could stop them. They ran this portable operation for 7 cremations. "We'd just come set it up at the end of your cul-de-sac," Paul said. The portapyre was a low-tech system, built from cinder blocks with a grate laid on top. The intense heat would cause the grate to warp and sag after every cremation. We had to drive a truck over the top of it to get it flat again, Stephanie said. It seems crazy, looking back at it now, she added, amused but not apologetic. In 2006, the pair began searching for a more permanent location for the pyre. Crestone seemed like the perfect place, the very definition of rural, 4 hours south of Denver, population 137 people, 1,400 in the surrounding areas. This gives Crestone a libertarian, government out of my business sort of edge. Weed is legal there, as are brothels. Not that there are any brothels in operation, but there could be. The town attracts a melange of spiritual seekers. People come from all over the world to meditate there, the Dalai Lama included. Flyers at the natural food store advertised Qigong instructors, shadow wisdom teachers, retreats for children to awaken their natural genius, retreats for North African dance class, and something called the Enchanted Forest Sacred Space. Crestone's residents include hippies and trustafarians, but many who live here are serious lifelong practitioners, Buddhists, Sufis, and Carmelite nuns. Laura herself had spent decades as a devotee of the Indian philosopher Sri Aurobindo. Paul and Stephanie's first proposal for the permanent pyre location was squelched when landowners downwind of the site, smokers, mind you, Paul pointed out, developed a serious case of not in my backyard. They were curmudgeons, Stephanie said, uninterested in evidence showing no threat of wildfires, unpleasant smells, mercury poisoning, or particulate matter. The smokers wrote letters to the county board and the Environmental Protection Agency. To fight them, the Portapyre crew went legit. They created a nonprofit, the Crestone End of Life Project. They filed motion after motion, collected 400 signatures, almost a third of the surrounding area, and amassed huge binders full of legal documents and scientific papers. They even visited the residents of Crestone one by one and listened to their concerns. At first, they met strong resistance. One man in the anti-pyre camp termed the group neighbors burning neighbors. When Paul and Stephanie suggested, as a joke, sponsoring a float in the local parade, a family came forward protesting that it was horribly disrespectful to feature a float decorated with papier-mâché flames. Folks in town even worried that a pyre would bring too much traffic, Stephanie said. Keep in mind that for Crestone, 6 cars is traffic. Paul explained, there's a lot of fear. What about air pollution? Is it not morbid? Death stuff gives me the creeps. You have to stay patient. Listen to what they're asking for. Paul and Stephanie kept going, in spite of the overwhelming legal hurdles, because the idea of the pyre inspired the community. Recall that the residents were so excited about the chance to be cremated on a pyre that they were summoning Paul and Stephanie to set up a cinder block grill in their driveways. How many people provide a service that actually resonates with other people? Stephanie asked. If it's not resonating, forget it. It was that resonance that fed me. They at last found their pyre a stable home, outside of town, a few hundred yards off the main road. The land was donated by Dragon Mountain Temple, a Zen Buddhist group. They don't keep the pyre hidden. As you drive into town, there's a metal sign with a single flame reading, Pyre. The sign was handmade by a local potato farmer, also the coroner, and stands as an obvious landmark. The pyre itself sits on a bed of sand, ringed with a bamboo wall that swoops and curves like calligraphy. Over 50 people have been cremated there, including, dramatic twist, the neighbor's burning neighbor's guy, who had a change of heart prior to his death. 3 days before Laura's cremation, volunteers from the Crestone End of Life Project came to her home. They prepared her body, helped her friends wash her, and laid her out on a cooling blanket to slow down any decomposition. They dressed her in natural fabrics. Synthetics like polyester don't perform well on the pyre. The organization will assist a family with its post-mortem logistics, regardless of finances. The family doesn't have to choose open-air cremation, either. The volunteers at Crestone End of Life are prepared to help whether the family chooses a conventional or embalmed burial, a natural burial, meaning no vault or embalming, or a cremation at the funeral home several towns over. Paul referred to that last option as commercial cremation. Stephanie interrupted. Paul, you're supposed to call it conventional cremation. No, I argued. Commercial cremation sounds right. Crestone was inspiring to me as a practitioner, which is why I kept returning. But there was also a touch of melancholy that bordered on jealousy. They had this glorious pyre under the blue sky, while I had to take my families to a loud, dusty crematory in a warehouse on the outskirts of town. I'd even promised to invite the didgeridoo player if I could have access to such a spectacular cremation facility for my funeral home. Industrial furnace cremation was first proposed in Europe in the late 19th century. In 1869, a group of medical experts gathered in Florence, Italy, to denounce burial as unhygienic and advocate a switch to cremation. Almost simultaneously, the pro-cremation movement jumped the pond to America, led by reformers such as the absurdly named Reverend Octavius B. Frothingham, who believed it was better for the dead body to transform into white ashes than a mass of corruption. My next drone folk album will be called The Cremation Reforms of Octavius B. Frothingham. The first body to undergo a modern scientific cremation in America was that of Baron Joseph Henry Louis Charles de Palme. Scratch that. The drone folk album is now The Burning of Baron de Palme. The good baron, a penniless Austrian nobleman, whom the New York Tribune called principally famous as a corpse, literal and figurative burn, died in May 1876. His cremation was scheduled for December, 6 months after his death. In the interim, his corpse was injected with arsenic, and when arsenic was deemed too weak to prevent rot, his organs were pulled from his body and his skin was covered in clay and carbolic acid by a local undertaker. On the train journey from New York to Pennsylvania, where he would be cremated, his mummified corpse briefly went missing in the baggage car, launching what historian Stephen Prothero called a macabre game of hide-and-seek. The crematory for this inaugural event was built on a physician's estate in Pennsylvania. It contained a coal-fire furnace that was supposed to cremate the body without the flames even having to touch it. The heat alone would disintegrate the corpse. Even though the physician said the cremation would be a strictly scientific and sanitary experiment, de Palme's body was still sprinkled with spices and placed on a bed of roses, palms, primroses, and evergreens. When the body first went into the furnace, observers reported a distinct smell of burning flesh, but the smell soon gave way to the aromas of flour and spice. After an hour in the furnace, de Palme's body began to glow with a rose mist. The glow turned gold and finally shone transparent red. After 2.5 hours, the body had disintegrated into bone and ash. Newspapermen and reviewers at the scene declared that the experiment had resulted in the first careful and inodorous baking of a human being in an oven. From there, cremation machines only grew larger, faster, and more efficient. Almost 150 years later, cremation has reached record heights in popularity. For the first time in 2017, more Americans will be cremated than buried. But the aesthetics and ritual surrounding the process have hardly changed. Our cremation machines still resemble the models introduced in the 1870s, 24,000-pound behemoths of steel, brick, and concrete. They gobble thousands of dollars worth of natural gas a month, spewing carbon monoxide, soot, sulfur dioxide, and highly toxic mercury, from dental fillings, into the atmosphere. Most crematories, especially in larger cities, are relegated to industrial zones, tucked inside nondescript warehouses. Of the three crematories I have worked at in my 9 years in the funeral industry, one was across from the Los Angeles Times distribution warehouse, where freight trucks rumbled out at all hours. One was behind a structural and termite warehouse, who knows what they do there, and one was next door to a junkyard, where cars were torn apart for scrap metal. One might find a crematory located on the grounds of a cemetery, but those facilities are most often hidden within the cemetery's maintenance buildings, meaning mourners who wish to attend the cremation must navigate John Deere mowers and piles of rotting flower wreaths collected from the graves. Some crematories are styled as celebration of life facilities or cremation tribute centers. Families are kept behind glass windows in air-conditioned rooms, watching as the body disappears into a small metal door in the wall. The machine concealed behind the wall is the same industrial oven found in the warehouses, but the family cannot see the wizard behind the curtain. The camouflage removes the family further from the reality of death and of the clunky, environmentally inefficient machines. For the privilege of taking Mom to a cremation tribute center, the price may rise above $5,000. I'm not arguing that a switch to open-air cremation would resolve all these issues. In countries where pyre cremation is the norm, such as India and Nepal, the many millions of cremations every year burn 50 million-plus trees and release carbon aerosols into the atmosphere. After carbon dioxide, carbon aerosols are the second leading man-made cause of climate change. But the Crestone model comes close. The nonprofit has received several calls from reformers in India wanting to adopt the structure and methods of their pyre, raised high off the ground to use less wood and release less damaging pollution. If reform is possible for this ancient method, inextricably tied to religion and country, then reform is possible for the modern industrial cremation machines as well. Laura had lived in Crestone for years, and it seemed as if the whole town had come to the pyre that morning. Her son, Jason, spoke the first words, his gaze focused on the flames. "Mom, thank you for the love," he said, his voice cracking. "Don't worry about us now. Fly and be free." As the fire continued to burn, a woman came forward to describe her own arrival in Crestone 11 years prior. When she moved to town, she had been suffering from years of chronic illness. "I moved to Crestone to find joy. I thought it was the clouds and the open sky that healed me, but I think it really was Laura." "We're all just human beings," another of her friends added. "We all have faults, but Laura, I didn't see no faults about her." The flames had made quick work of Laura's coral shroud. As mourners spoke, the flames jumped to her exposed flesh and the layers of soft tissue. The fire dehydrated the tissue, the majority of which was water, which shriveled and withered away. This exposed her internal organs, next to succumb to the flames. This would be a macabre spectacle for the uninitiated, but the nonprofit volunteers were vigilant in concealing the pyre's inner workings from the crowd. They moved with grace and expertise, ensuring there was no odor, no threat of a rogue head or charred arm popping into view. "We're not trying to hide the body from people," Stephanie explained. "But the cremations are often open to the entire community, and you never know who is going to be there, and how they're going to respond to the intensity of feeling the pyre can provoke. People imagine themselves lying on that pyre one day." As the ceremony proceeded, the volunteers crept imperceptibly around the pyre, adding wood. Over the course of the cremation, the nonprofit burned one-third of a cord of wood, 42.6 cubic feet. As the flames burned on, they reached Laura's bones. The knees, heels, and facial bones were first. It took longer for the fire to reach her pelvis and arm and leg bones. The water evaporated from her skeleton, followed by the organic material. The color of her bones transformed from white to gray to black and then back to white once more. The weight of the logs pressed Laura's bones through the metal grate to the ground below. One of the fire tenders pulled out a long metal pole, sending it into the fire. The pole pushed through the space where Laura's head had been, but the skull had vanished. I had been told that each cremation at Crestone was unique. Some were straightforward, of the light-me-up-and-go variety. Others lasted hours as mourners performed elaborate religious and spiritual ceremonies. Some were more casual, like the cremation of a young man who wanted half a gallon of tequila and a joint placed on his pyre.
"Well, I can tell you everyone downwind enjoyed it," one volunteer told me.
What remains consistent is that the pyre experience, for those present, is transformative. The youngest person they have cremated was Travis, just 22 years old, who died in a car crash. According to the police report, he and his friends were drunk and high, speeding too fast down a dark rural road. The car flipped, and Travis was ejected and declared dead at the scene. All of the young people from Crestone and the surrounding towns had come to take part in his cremation. As Travis's body was laid on the pyre, his mother pulled down his shroud to kiss his forehead. Travis's father grabbed the driver by the face and in front of the community said, "Look at me. I forgive you." Then the pyre was lit. About an hour into Laura's cremation, the pall of grief had lifted from the circle. The last speaker came forward to address the crowd in a way that would have been inappropriate just 90 minutes earlier.
"Everything you all said about how Laura was a wonderful person, that's true. But in my mind, she will always be one of the wild crones, a partier. I'd like to give her a howl." "Oh!"
she bellowed, with the crowd joining in around her. Even I, who had just recently been too timid to drop my juniper bough on the pyre, let out a tentative howl. By 9:30 that morning, only Stephanie and I, and what remained of Laura, were left at the pyre, sitting on a carved wooden bench. Just three logs remained among the embers in their gentle end-stage burn. An infrared gun from the fire department measured these embers at over 1,250 degrees. Stephanie is often the first to arrive and the last to leave the cremation site. "I like the silence," she said. Stephanie stayed still for a few minutes, and then suddenly she was on her feet again. She picked up a piece of metal grating and examined it. "This is Paul's new spark protector design. It's supposed to keep the ashes contained on a windy night. Chunks of wood can't get out, but what about sparks from the embers?" Within a couple of minutes, Stephanie was on the phone with the fire department to arrange spark protector tests and an inspection. Her boundless energy didn't allow her to remain idle for long. I wondered how she had been able to summon the years of patience required to make this pyre a reality. It was exhausting, waiting for the community to accept us. It was so hard for me not to drag people in. The longer I spent in Crestone, the more it seemed like a morbid Mayberry. The nonprofit hosts get-togethers for locals to make sure their end-of-life paperwork is in order. People stop Stephanie in the post office to say, "I'm glad you're here. I'm coming to the next meeting to fill out my advance directive." People in Crestone just know what to do when someone dies. The volunteers who go into homes to prepare the bodies told me that families have started to tell them, "Oh, thanks for coming, but it's okay, we'll take it from here." Even the corpses have a small-town feel. One woman decided she wanted to be buried in Crestone's natural burial ground, the first in the state. When she died, her daughters drove her body down from Denver in the back of a truck in a Rubbermaid container filled with ice. "We didn't have anywhere to put the woman until burial," Stephanie said, "so we decided to keep her overnight in the town museum." The daughters liked that idea. "Mom was such a history buff. She would have been into that." The natural burial ground is open to anyone, but the pyre is restricted to those living in the community. The nonprofit receives calls from all over the country, from Hindus, Buddhists, Native Americans, and general pyre enthusiasts who want their bodies sent to Crestone after they die.
As a small volunteer operation, they just don't have the ability or manpower to handle out-of-town corpses. Even if they did, the local commissioner only allows them to serve the surrounding county. Having to decline is difficult for both sides. The only time they made an exception was when a hiker from Georgia, missing for 9 months and the subject of a massive search, was found. Well, a portion of him was found, his spine, his hip, and a leg. They agreed to do the cremation, deciding that he had established his residency post-mortem. The pyre funeral is so appealing that some people have even bought land in Crestone just to qualify for an open-air cremation. A 42-year-old woman dying of cervical cancer obtained a small plot of land, and when she died, her 12-year-old daughter helped prepare her body for the pyre. This existential longing for the pyre's fiery embrace is common worldwide. In India, family members transport dead bodies to a row of cremation pyres along the banks of the Ganges River. When a father dies, his pyre will be lit by his eldest son. As the flames grow hotter, his flesh bubbles and burns away. At just the right time, a wooden staff is brought forth and used to crack open the dead man's skull. At that moment, it is believed the man's soul is released. A son, describing the cremation of his parents, wrote that, "Before breaking the skull, you shiver, for this person was alive just a few hours back. But once you hit the skull, you know what burns in front of you is, after all, just a body. All attachments are gone. The soul is set free as an Indian spiritual song intones over a loudspeaker. Death, you think you have defeated us, but we sing the song of burning firewood." Pitu Laugani, a Hindu living in the West, explains the pain of witnessing a commercial, industrialized cremation. Instead of placing the body onto the wood of the pyre, mourners watch the coffin slide off on an electrically operated carousel and drop into a concealed hole. Locked away in the steel and brick-lined chamber, when the skull cracks open, the man's soul will be imprisoned in the machine, forced to mingle with the thousands of other souls the machine has trapped. It will be an akal myarta, a bad death. For the family, the whole process can be an unnerving and even grotesque experience. Davinder Ghai, a Hindu activist, has fought Newcastle City Council in England for years to legalize pyres like the one in Crestone. Ghai won the court battle, and open-air pyres may soon be a reality in the UK. He explained that being bundled into a box and incinerated in a furnace is not my idea of dignity, much less the performance of an ancient sacrament. It would be simple to allow open-air pyres in any community that wanted them. Yet government cemetery and funeral boards put up enormous resistance to the idea. Like the curmudgeonly neighbors in Crestone, they argue that outdoor pyres would prove too hard to control, and that they would impact air quality and the environment in unknown ways. Crestone has proven that open-air pyres can be inspected for safety compliance just like any industrial crematory. Environmental agencies can run tests to determine the environmental impact and regulate accordingly. So, why do these local governments continue to resist? The answer is as bleak as it is obvious. Money. The average American funeral costs $8,000 to $10,000, not including the burial plot and cemetery costs. A Crestone end-of-life funeral costs $500, technically a donation to cover wood, fire department presence, stretcher, and land use. To put this cost in perspective, that's roughly 5% of the price of a traditional American funeral. If you don't have the money but are a member of the community, the nonprofit will even forego its fee. Ghai promises a similar model for pyre cremations in the UK. He plans to charge £900, but says, "We will do this as a charity, for free. They only need to find the land." In the 21st century, removing money and profit from death is almost unheard of, mostly because it's so difficult to accomplish.
After Hurricane Katrina, a group of Benedictine monks in southern Louisiana began selling low-cost, handmade cypress caskets. The state's board of embalmers and funeral directors drummed up a cease and desist order, claiming that only funeral homes licensed by their board could sell funeral merchandise. Eventually, a federal judge sided with the monks, saying it was clear there was no public health risk from the sale of the caskets, and the motivation of the board was solely economic protectionism. Legally and logistically, circumventing the funeral industry and its regulations to create a nonprofit death service for the community is nearly impossible. In this landscape, where funeral boards are coming after monks, it is a challenge to convey how truly astounding the accomplishments at Crestone are. The morning after the funeral in Crestone, I entered the cremation circle and was greeted by two adorable dogs bounding around the pyre. McGregor, Stephanie's brother and volunteer ash gatherer, had arrived early that morning to sift through Laura's remains, 4.5 gallons of bone and cinders. From the ash pile, he pulled out the largest bone fragments, chunks of femur, rib, and skull, which some families like to take home and keep as relics. There were significantly more ashes in this pile than after a typical commercial cremation, which leaves only as much remains as can fit in a Folgers coffee can. In California, we are required to grind the bones in a silver machine called the cremulator until they are unrecognizable bone fragments. The state frowns on distributing the larger, recognizable bones to the family. Several of Laura's friends wanted a portion of the ashes, and any excess would be scattered in the hills around the pyre or further into the mountains. "She would have loved that," Jason said. "She's everywhere now." I asked Jason if anything had changed for him since the cremation yesterday. "My mom brought me up to see the pyre the last time I visited. I was confused. I thought that I was going to have to sit on that bench there and cremate my mom alone, all by myself. It seemed so morbid. 3 days ago, I was horrified at what I was coming to Crestone to do. But mom had told me, this is what I've chosen for my body. You can come or not." When Jason arrived for his mother's wake in her home, things began to shift. By the time of the cremation, he had realized that he had a whole community by his side. There were talks and songs, and he allowed himself to be supported by everyone who loved his mother. That was moving to me. It changed things. Crouched down over the ashes, McGregor explained to Laura's son Jason what they were looking at. He demonstrated how brittle the bones were after being subjected to the heat, crumbling a small fragment into ash with his hand. "What's this?" Jason asked, pulling out a small piece of metal from the pile. It was the iridescent face of a Swatch watch that Laura had been wearing when she was brought to the pyre. Warped into rainbow colors by the heat of the fire, it was stopped forever at 7:16 a.m., the moment the flames took hold. Indonesia, South Sulawesi. There is a remote region in Indonesia where people are present with their dead at a length we can't even begin to conceive, the holy grail of corpse interaction. For years, I thought visiting this place was beyond my reach, but I had forgotten one crucial thing. I knew Dr. Paul Koudinaris. One day in the spring, I sat in the home of Dr. Paul, scholar of the macabre and longtime Los Angeles cult treasure. By sat, I mean I perched directly on the hardwood floor. Paul's home in Los Angeles, which he calls the Moroccan Pirate Castle, has no furniture. There are, however, clusters of taxidermied animals, Renaissance paintings, and Middle Eastern lanterns suspended from the ceiling. "I'm going to Tanatoraja for the Manene in August," he said, with a nonchalance only Paul can pull off. For the last 12 years, he's traveled all over the world, photographing everything from the burial caves in Rwanda, to Czech churches decorated in human bone, to mummified monks in Thailand covered head to toe in gold leaf. This is a guy who, in order to transport himself